Matthews digs it back. Nylander has to hustle and can't keep it in. Stopped it up, and it's an empty net for Thompson. And Buffalo's got a 5-2 lead.
We're going to get more than enough opportunity to play against teams that are not in the bottom half of the league. And we'll read a little more into who we are as a team when that happens.
The Fan Morning Show. Sports at 590 The Fan. Blake Murphy. Justin Cuthbert. J.D. Bunkus. What a up and down weekend for Toronto sports teams. The Toronto Raptors with a shocking sweep of back-to-back against two of the best teams in the league. The Toronto Blue Jays back in the transaction market, adding Yusei Kikuchi and Andrew Vasquez. Josh Donaldson's off to the Yankees. But of course, that clip leading us in is your Toronto Maple Leafs are a disaster against bad teams. Sheldon Keefe better hope he's right that better days are ahead and better measuring sticks are ahead against good teams, because this team cannot handle the dregs of the league. 5-2 loss to the Buffalo Sabres in the Heritage Classic in Hamilton. Cuthbert, you were there. You warmed up yet? Are you still chilly? What's going on?
Unfortunately, it wasn't the full experience for media members. The press box up there is pretty well insulated, so I felt like I didn't even like experience the outdoor game at all. It was like looking into a snow globe outside of it, like a giant snow globe, and just seeing snow falling and
fraudulent
action inside. But I didn't really
ooh
experience
la,
the outdoor
fancy media
game.
People.
It was no, yeah, it was not good. It was not good. I'd rather be grinding out there with
Elliot Friedman's out there changing jackets every segment. He's got his hair windswept with little bits of snow in it. And Justin Cuthbert's by the fire with his cocoa.
Yeah.
Not hearing a single sound.
Did you see Kevin Bieksa get hit with the fan telling him to try his glizzy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, that was an all-time broadcasting moment for me, was also, him asking, what is this? And him saying, it's a glizzy. Here's, take it.
Yeah.
I was never more thrilled than that. That was the most exciting part of the broadcast to me.
Fellas, dress your hot dogs. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to give one away, though, that one I understand.
I'm sure he didn't buy that with the intention. It seems like Bieksa just kind of surprised those guys. And that weird guy who was his uncle or his cousin.
Yeah, that's
bizarre. bizarre couple minutes from Kevin Bieksa there.
That was quite the segment idea. They were like, let's just go up here.
Look, if they wanted... If they wanted people to just be in the crowd drinking with fans, well, you've got a morning show that could do that pretty seamlessly.
I would have really crushed that out of the park, I got to tell you. But I don't understand this team. I want to just hear from hockey historians today. That's what I want to hear from. Is are there teams like this? Because I've tracked the game for a while, and I know that it's different because we watch this team on a daily basis, and we watch them under this microscope, and we're so up close with it sometimes, right? And we've been so up close now with this core for the past couple of years where hope has been back in Toronto, that you forget sometimes that basically since the post-Sundin and basically since the salary cap up until this core, there has been this real absence of hope. This is the first time where there has been that since the cap. And I just, these guys are the weirdest team, where one night they look like real contenders and you think, man, like, why do we even criticize these guys? They get it way too harsh in this city. They are star talented. They've got some depth. They're really figuring it out. And they're going through the fire, quote unquote, in order to reach this Stanley Cup. And then you watch other nights where they play in a outdoor game. And at first I tell myself, well, don't put anything into this. It's an outdoor game, right? They're in a snowstorm. How are we really supposed to take anything in? But then they find the way to just lose to the Buffalo Sabres just in the kind of way where you go, what's up with these guys? You know? What is up with these guys? And I can't remember a team like it. I really cannot remember a team like them. Do you guys remember a team like them? Honestly, across any sport, is there a team that you really can remember that is quite like this Leafs team where they Jekyll and Hyde you all the way through a season like this, and it's one thing after another. It's never just one thing. It's, is it this thing now? And you go, I think it kind of is that thing. And then all of a sudden that thing disappears and it's completely flying. It's so bizarre. They are so bizarre. And I just, I am in some part grateful for them because they are just nonstop entertainment. But also, I just think that, yeah, they are the hardest team to watch as well. They're the hardest team to talk about as well.
The easiest comparison, and it's overly easy, is the Raptors, who just, like, they lose a back-to-back at home to Detroit and Orlando, and then they win a back-to-back on the road against Phoenix and Denver. But the easy
expectations for them are exactly like, in the bottom of the bottom. Like, nobody cares what the Raptors do this year.
And you expect an average team to have highs and lows. You don't expect a team that believes it's a top three team in the league to have lows that low. No. Maybe the highs that high, sure, but man, they are tough to figure out.
When you break it down in its components, like you gotta, like, what are the problems that the Oilers have? Clearly, they have two great players, generational talents. Everything else is pretty awful around them. And the Leafs are sort of trending that way. Like, if John Tavares and William Nylander are not going to play up to the even close to their contracts, the Leafs are the Oilers, but with a good third line. With a third line that can actually make a difference out there, because other than that, it's kind of built the same, where the goaltending has been awful. The defense, well, they got one defenseman that can play, or I guess two defensemen that can play, and not much else after that. And if nothing else is working, then you're just leaning on those guys at the top. And when you do lean on generational talents, it just swings one way or the other so dramatically, because they can do so much, but then everybody else lets them down. I mean, like, we're trending towards that, which is so problematic.
I'm getting to the point now where obviously the Mrazek thing is such a problem that you can try to address the goaltending all you want, but I don't know how much I'm sacrificing. I thought about this a lot yesterday, how not only is Jack the real option because of what you can get and upgrade in net, Jack is also the only realistic option, because if you go out and trade for a goaltender, I think that anybody's going to snap under this pressure. I don't think that there's a goaltender on the planet that's going to step into Toronto right now with the expectations that are on this team and the market, the way that they handle an incoming player like that. Just what goalie's going to come in here and deal with that okay? Marc-Andre Fleury, you would say, okay, well, he's a vet. He's been around. He's seen all the things. Marc-Andre Fleury was a choker for a long part of his career. He was. Mm-hmm. He was an undoubtable choker. He went to Vegas. It was not a pressure-packed situation. It was the Raptors, Blake. It was the zero expectations. Oh, my God, they're actually doing this? Wow, everyone's behind you. Nobody cares. You're just a fun story. Everyone's backing you. Then there's a little bit of pressure in Vegas, and Marc-Andre Fleury was a little bit more streaky. Not that he was a choker. I think you can be a choker and then no longer be a choker. I really do. And I think he sort of worked out some of those issues. But are you telling me that you really trust Marc-Andre Fleury to show up in Toronto, where Kyle Dubas has called this an all-in season, or we've dubbed it an all-in season, the last dance, whatever you want to call it? The way that people are focused on this team, there's this laser focus on the goaltending, like, for the last bunch of seasons, basically since before the lockout with Freddie Anderson, when people really started to question whether he was the guy. You're going to drop some dude in here and tell me that Anton Forsberg is going to get hot? First bad game Anton Forsberg has, and he faces the media, and he turns on a radio or a podcast or looks at the internet or his Twitter account. Like, no way. Jack has at least been here. You got to hope that Jack can rebound and get this together in some way, because I just don't think there's a really good option out there. I think my take for the deadline is starting to become more and more, just leave it as is. Because these guys are reminding me a little bit more like the Tyson Barrie Leafs before the lockout, where you went, I don't know if these guys can win. I really don't know. And
they
I
don't
think
deserve
there's too
it.
Many holes. There's too. I don't even know if it's a matter of deserve, Justin.
That's what it was in 2020. Just, 2020 is they don't deserve it.
But they were flawed. They were really flawed. And 100%. These guys, some nights they look terrific, and I think they could win. But I don't think that there's one issue that you can address. You need to address the goaltending. You could really use a second line winger. You could at least use a little bit of winger depth. And of course, you could use a top four blue liner. And are you really going to correct all those things? We keep making this fantasy trade up of, oh, well, then they go to Chicago and they get Fleury and Hagel and Murphy. It's just, that's not going to happen. We all know that's not going to happen. And so if I'm Kyle Dubas, it almost feels kind of irresponsible to be saying, well, we might trade a Robertson or a first round pick or something of that caliber in a market where there doesn't appear to be that many interesting players, and for a team that has a lot of holes. So it just, there's this weird thing happening here. It's a total whirlwind of weird team that has problems that are oftentimes hard to identify, unbelievably weak trade market with super high costs to acquire things that don't seem to have a major impact, and then the goaltending quagmire thing where you kind of look at it and go, well, that situation is so weird that what's the point in trading for a fourth defenseman if you end up with a guy in net who can't make a save? They're just, again, mind-boggling team. They're so weird. They're the weirdest team.
The market pressure is an interesting one because a lot of people say, Toronto media. Honestly, these guys do not get it like they could get it. The kids' gloves are on for Peter Mrazek and Jack Campbell. It is not even close to what it could be and what it is in other markets. But you're right. The market pressure is there. And honestly, I don't think it's media-made. I think it's self-inflicted. They've put themselves in this position where it is so meaningful because we understand the backdrop of this fan base and how big it is, but their continued failures is what's made this into a behemoth.
Sure.
Yes, when they lose in the playoffs, it's a different tone. It's very serious. It brings out that pressure, scrutiny, microscope thing. But during the course of this season, like Peter Mrazek right now, he gets through those media sessions unscathed when he cannot, for the life of him, after being paid $3.8 million over three seasons, can't do his job. And he does not get it. He does not get what he could get in terms of media scrutiny. And I'm not saying it's too easy. I'm not saying it's anything. I think he's just unfit for the job. But I think if you did bring in someone, and it might be Fleury, but someone who's been through it all a little bit, and I'm not saying that that's the reason to go out and get Fleury, but it is the reason that Mrazek is not capable of doing the job here, I think. He can't handle this pressure, and I think it's being a Toronto Maple Leaf that brings that pressure and the backdrop of all this pressure to win. But I honestly don't think he's dreading coming and meeting the media because everyone's treating him
I don't think it's a media thing, and sometimes it's overblown, but I think the constant having the media around and even this many people covering the team and this many story angles, that definitely contributes to it. To me, it's just you can feel the pressure probably in that room, and you can feel the pressure in the stadiums whenever you're letting goals. What do you think, Blake?
Yeah, I think, look, I don't think the media is unfairly anything on this thing. And like Mrazek, sure, he's skated a little bit, and I think part of that is that Jack's hurt or that Jack's been bad as well, and that shields him a little bit, because what's the answer, right? What do you do with this? But in terms of addressing it via trade or whatever, like Marc-Andre Fleury has an .892 save percentage over his last 16 games. Mm-hmm. Like they're just that we've talked around potential external solutions, and they're just not there when you look at the cost or the certainty of an upgrade. I think we're at a spot where, yeah, in between the pipes, all we're left to hope with right now is that this break to get Jack's rib right also gets Jack's head right, and then he comes back and is something between where he was to start the season and where he was before he hit the injured list, because there help's not coming through the door, I don't think.
That's what I'm saying, is the hopes that some of us have had, and I don't mind us kicking around the question. I'm glad that we've done it and that we do these things where we go, hey, who's the best option? Is it Anton Forsberg? And everyone gets an opinion as to what would help the Leafs goaltending the best. To me, it's just, who can you add for the lowest sort of asset cost as a backup to Mrazek? Because I think at this point, you're basically cutting Mrazek, or you're waving him, you're sending him down to the Marlies. I'm not giving up a first-round pick to get off of the Mrazek contract. I'm sorry. Kyle Dubas has already had those trades, and I know, whatever. Some of them haven't been his fault. The Marlowe one is something from before him, right? The Richie deal is his, and it's a second-round pick, but it's far enough down the line where you go, oh, okay, well, that's not that big of a deal. But I'm not giving up a first-round pick just to get off of this contract. No way. I'm not giving up a second-round pick to get off of this contract. No way. You need those things. You are going to need those things to build around this roster a little bit better, but part of me just looks at it and goes, you're going to need an offseason, I think. You're going to need an offseason where you can tinker with the blue line a little bit, where you can ask yourself the real question of, hey, I'm sorry to do this because nobody likes doing this because you just get flamed. But is it back to trading Nylander time and trying to reconfigure this roster around him? Because I think it's pretty clear now that you're going Marner and Matthews are that core two, and you're not moving Tavares. There's just no way that you're getting out from that contract. And you've just signed Riley to an extension. So that's essentially your core, right? Can you do something where you move Muzzin off the books during the offseason? Can you do something where you make a bit of a transformational trade where you can shake things up and add more depth or change the complexion of this team? I think that right now there are too many things to address. There aren't enough things on the market. And the goaltending pressure situation remains just such a huge question that I just don't believe in the idea that Anton Forsberg or Marc-Andre Fleury and trading massive amount of assets to acquire guys like that is all of a sudden going to change the ceiling of your team.
So I have a one big number here just to kind of close out the thought of like, oh, well, is this as bad as the media makes it, or is it better than the media makes it, or whatever. I went back to the start of the 2010 season and pulled all the Leafs game logs. This is the worst 12-game stretch of save percentage for the Toronto Maple Leafs going back at least as far as 2010. That's as far back as I went. I figured, you know, 12 years was enough, and I only had a couple minutes this morning to pull the data. This is the worst. 12 games at 85.1% is the worst 12-game stretch the Leafs have had in at least over a decade.
Right, which is, again,
so I don't think we're making too big a deal of it.
Yeah, but could they improve it? Of course, they can improve it with anyone. My point is that we've now seen this for a while now, right? Why is it that the Leafs face a 42-year-old Craig Anderson last night, and we're going, oh, this guy is barely alive. Is he ever going to be able to get to this many wins? And then all of a sudden against the Leafs, he looks competent. And the Leafs have now had years of Freddie Anderson and Jack Campbell, and now Peter Mrazek comes in here, and a variety of different backups who have struggled and whatever. It just always kind of seems to come back to some. I really do think that we underestimate how hard it is to be a goalie on this team with these expectations and how easily it can sort of break you. I don't know if it's just the guys they have. I don't know if it's they're bad at identifying goaltenders, but there's just seems to be something about this situation where I don't have a lot of faith in who they go out and net, and all of a sudden it just changing the ceiling of the team. I think, again, you get better than Mrazek because Blake just said it. You got to go back a decade to get worse than Mrazek. But I just don't see the one guy coming in here and being, okay, well, now they're back to contenders.
Yeah, and Mrazek understood, right? He understood coming in. He in his introductory press conference, he talked about what it meant to be a Leaf and what he knew about the Leafs when he was growing up. He understood everything that went into playing goal for the Toronto Maple Leafs. And I think when you're trying to identify the problem, that's part of it is, you know, perhaps they're there is some talent evaluation stuff for sure, but maybe there's something to wanting to play and understanding what it means to play for the Leafs and then buckling under that pressure. Honestly, where I'm at with this and what they have to do before the deadline, is there someone for a fourth or fifth round pick? Maybe it's Anton Forsberg. You might have to pay a little bit more. That's just blissfully unaware
for a fourth.
Someone who is just blissfully unaware that doesn't understand what this really means, can work in a silo and can just play the position. Because going out and getting that guy who's desperate to be a Maple Leaf, I don't think that works because of all the pressure that goes into it. It just seems like everyone buckles under that pressure, Mrazek included.
Did you guys put any extra stock in yesterday? Because I go a little back and forth on this where I thought, hey, seems like we're putting a little too much on a outdoor game that's being played in the snow. That, because at the first period I went, what are we supposed to take away from this game, honestly? Like, what are we actually supposed to be able to evaluate from this game? And then it is the Sabres, and it is in front of a different crowd, and they do find just this way to lose it, and they don't recover from the bad Mrazek goal, and part of me goes, maybe there is a little something to this the moment thing. Do you put any stock in the Winter Classic game, Blake? Or Heritage Classic, or whatever you want to put it, as a moment game?
Not anything extra, because they had just lost a bunch of games like this as well, right? Like, they just lost to Buffalo a couple weeks ago in a game that wasn't important. They lost the Coyotes in a game that wasn't
the first one that had fans back, I think, right? The Buffalo loss?
I mean, they had played road games with fans, but yeah. I don't know. I don't put a ton into it. I just felt like I was trying to sell myself. Like, after that first period, Mrazek has 12 saves or whatever, and none of them are like crazy spectacular. And I'm like, okay, maybe he's getting back. Like, this will help. This will be a good spot. And then I'm like, no, you're reaching, man. And then every deflection starts going in, and Brody's potting one on him and stuff. No, I felt like I was reaching for it a little bit, but it's kind of the pattern of the last 2 weeks.
But you also don't think, like Cuthbert, how a goalie for me of Mrazek or Campbell right now, I have belief that they can start a game well and make those saves early. What's always scares you with when goalies are like this is what happens when something bad happens. What happens when one does go off Brody and you catch a bad break, or Jack Campbell, all the tips that went in against him the week before he left with an injury when he was struggling. It's how do you bounce back from those things? And right now, I don't have any faith either guy is going to have the ability to bounce back from those moments right now. That's the part that scares me.
Well, that's the one he couldn't do anything about. But the one that he could do something about was Vinny Hinostroza's second goal, where he completely left his post. I mean, that wasn't a fluke goal. That was Vinny Hinostroza seeing a goaltender do something he shouldn't do and take advantage of him. I mean, I think there is something to the big moment when going back to if anything matters from this game. I think there is something about the big stage that spooks this team for whatever reason, maybe more so the goalies. But, like, you can say it doesn't mean anything, and Sheldon Keefe wanted to spin that narrative. But guess what? Everything that has dogged this team over the last 2 weeks to 6 weeks, I guess, manifested itself in this game. The goaltending issues. We saw Ilya Lyubushkin play with Morgan Rielly for the bulk of the game because, guess what? That top pairing wasn't working with Timothy Liljegren, and William Nylander and John Tavares were terrible. Literally everything that has been a problem for this team over the last month was a problem again outdoors. No matter the setting, it seems, these Leafs right now are these Leafs.
Man, I thought the Tavares thing behind the net was an obvious penalty. And to me, there's a little bit of a... I hate saying this, but there's almost a little bit of a Dion Phaneuf thing happening to me where I watch Tavares and I go, there's just this non... The respect for him as a captain doesn't appear to be the same as other guys around the league. Whether it's officials or the way that other teams treat him or whatever, it reminds me a little bit of Dion. You remember when Phaneuf, there were guys that would take runs at Dion that were like AHL players, where all of a sudden they were trying to fight him and you went, what is happening here? Well, get out of Dion's face. This guy's an NHL player. He's a captain. And there's this nobody that comes up and wants to challenge him. I just felt that way with Tavares last night where I go, what captain gets dumped like that behind the net in that fashion, that way, and nobody really does anything? His bench reacted pretty well, but it's just there's a little touch of that right now that and makes me feel a little uncomfortable. You're right. They were pretty ghostly. That pairing didn't work out again yesterday. I actually had moments where I went, man, Liljegren looks good, and then there's some moments where you go, wow, what's that supposed to be? And then, ultimately just the goaltending outdoes them. My favorite part, though, is they lose that game and – they flash up to the media booth and you see Kyle Dubas and Brendan Shanahan in their newsboy outfits and you go, boy, that's a tough look when you lose, you know? That's all cute when you're showing up to the stadium in your little costumes, but when you lose to the Sabres for the second time in a week and they show you up there, you go, guys, take the newsboy hats off, okay? The extra, extra, you guys blew it again. Take those off. Take those stupid hats off. I'm going to freeze that. I'm definitely going to frame that in my apartment if they end up just like having this be a disaster that never works out. That's going to be a lasting image for me.
I mean, the Maple Leafs did build a lead that they couldn't hold, and the jokes were built right in when they walked in with construction gear, but it was the Dubas newsboy hat that was more memeable, honestly.
The newsboy hat was quite a thing. I just thought, you guys, take them off. Why are they still on?
Throw them at the wall or something.
Yeah, somebody do something with those hats. Anyway, plenty more today. No Justin Bourne today. He's doing stuff. But we've got Rick Tocchet, who was covering the game yesterday. And I am really curious to hear from Rick just how weird he finds this team, or whether or not this is just me and we're too close to it. And I don't know. Like, I find them to be so perplexing and so strange. The Jays made a move this weekend. They went out and got a starting pitcher. There was also rumors that they were going to go get an all-time hated Jay, and we're going to have Ennis on at 7 o'clock and talk about that a little bit more in detail with him. But Kikuchi signs for a 3-year, $36 million deal. I got to admit, a little bit of a surprise to me, but not so much the name, the number, just considering what happened with the Mariners. I had followed his negotiations. He turned down a $13 million player option, and it was viewed as a pretty bold move on Kikuchi's part, given that he's worn down over the last three seasons. And that's kind of the book on this guy is as the season goes on, he sort of wears down. And so for a team like the Blue Jays that's trying to, you know, get better and get into the postseason and have horses late in the year, I thought it was a little interesting. But overall, okay. Blake, what did you think?
Yeah, I'm fine with it. First of all, the 336, and yeah, it's front loaded a little bit, but not in a way that changes the accounting.
It's
the
free agency,
here, really.
You know, like yeah. It's. I don't.
That's the price of 150 decent innings, right?
Yeah, 12 million a year. I wasn't freaking out. I just meant I was a little surprised by it because I would have guessed. Had you made me guess Kikuchi 3 years, I would have guessed somewhere like $28 million. So what are we talking about here? It's not a big deal.
Exactly. So there are a couple things with Kikuchi that stood out to me. And the first was actually what you said, JD, in terms of he wore down a little bit as the seasons have gone on. And immediately some of the reporting was, oh, this is a guy who can use an extra day off here and there. And I actually think that obviously that's not a bonus. You'd rather have a guy who could just go. But the way that they built this roster out and the way they've talked about Ryu toward the end of last year, I actually think it makes sense that you have two guys now that maybe need the extra day off. Because you've built a team up where you're probably going to have Stripling in the bullpen. You're either going to have Pearson in the bullpen or at AAA. You're going to have Thomas Hatch and Trent Thornton at AAA. Like, these aren't great names, but they're names that if you have to go to a six-man rotation some weeks, especially the season's going to be slightly more condensed than we anticipated because they have to slide those three extra games in somewhere. So I think that element of it is fine. Like, it's easier to work around two guys that need an extra day than just one because you're already dropping an extra pitcher in there. The other thing that stands out, obviously, is this guy's coming from a very hitter-friendly environment to a very pitcher-friendly environment to a less pitcher-friendly environment, and he had a monster home run per fly ball rate last year.
Yeah.
What the Jays see here, I'm almost certain, is that, well, he started missing way more bats and there are just fewer balls in play. So maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe we can ratchet up this ability to miss bats. That bat missing ability was pretty contingent on his fastball staying up around 96 instead of dipping down to like 94, where it did sometimes towards the end of the season. So that's the swing piece to watch. I don't know if there's the, you know, I know everyone rushes, and I can't even tell anymore how much of it is jokey and how much of it is serious. They're like, oh, Pete Walker. It's like, yeah, maybe Pete Walker just tells Kikuchi, hey, don't walk guys anymore like he did for Robbie Ray, and that fixes things. But a 10% walk rate in Rogers Center is at least a little worrisome. So you're looking at the strikeout rate getting further upward mobility, maybe into the mid-high 20% instead of down in the low-mid 20%.
Okay, so I have watched Kikuchi. I still keep an eye on the Mariners, right? I still end up watching them. They're my West Coast team. It's almost a shame that they're expanding the playoffs for the Mariners because they're never going to get to experience what Blue Jays fans did, which is finally getting over that hump of, oh, we did it. We got to the playoffs. We broke this horrible streak of missing it. Kikuchi, this is, again, an expectation thing. So it's going to be interesting for me to watch him through the lens of low expectations. Because when he showed up in Seattle, it was, hey, is this guy really good? That he might be really good. Here's what I can tell you about him. The velocity has dipped. It has become a real conversation, and it was a real conversation in Seattle as to what this guy could do. Wearing down was a very real thing for this guy. He's a slight frame dude. He's not exactly a powerhouse like Manoa. I don't consider him – he's someone who has eaten innings, but it's hard for me to consider you an innings eater when you slow down like this, where the velocity just starts to tail off and it's a completely different thing from the beginning of the season to the end of it. He was hot in the beginning of last year. He made the All-Star team, actually, and I don't know, that probably says more about the Mariners than anything else, but he was hot earlier last year, and you kind of went, okay, and then things, again, started to fall apart. The velocity dropped down, the strikeouts start to go away because he can miss bats, and the ground ball is another thing where it's like, that's what he needs to do, is he needs to keep it on the carpet, and when he does that, he ends up being all right. But Blake mentioned is, like, he's a dude who's super susceptible to the home run, and we were just talking about Mrazek, and do you trust a guy when things start to go bad? Kikuchi is the ultimate when things start to go bad guy. You feel bad. You don't feel as though it's get the bullpen ready. You know, this one left the yard. It's time. Get the bullpen ready. I just don't know what it means, Blake, when you have two guys that are that kind of question marks in Ryu and Kikuchi for that condensed season and for that stretch. They can always add an arm, I guess, if they end up especially not using assets right now. Pitching should be there for them. But I did wonder a little bit if this was, okay, we're going to use Nate Pearson at some point this year, and we're going to build him up. But this really gives us time for him to figure it out. And if he can figure it out, like, no team is going to ever go through a season with a five-man rotation. It happened to the Blue Jays that one season, remember, where they somehow miraculously went, yeah, we just only used five guys. There was a sixth guy. We pitched him in, like, two games, and that's what happens. So you're going to deal with injuries. You're going to need more than five starters anyways. So I love this as a depth move. Having Kikuchi is better than not having Kikuchi. But I did sort of look at it as they didn't go out and break the bank for another guy, and maybe that is a little Pearson related. I don't know. I'm trying to kind of connect the dots a little bit on this one.
Yeah, I think that's probably part of it. And, you know, maybe Stripling factors in there too. Like they tendered him, so they obviously see him as worth, you know, $4 million, $5 million in that range. And it's I look at the way the bullpen shapes up, and I think Stripling's probably your swing man to start the year, spot start or long reliever or whatever. Pearson does still have options left, which feels weird because he's like 40 years old at this point.
26 years old for Nate Pearson seems incredibly wrong. It doesn't seem, it feels like someone fast forwarded 3 years of his life. He should be 23. Why is Nate Pearson 26? Please explain. How did that work?
I think this is Pearson's last chance to go as a starter. Like you said, if they stretch him out and he's the first guy up from AAA, and anytime you need a sixth or whatever, I mean, it wouldn't even shock me if they go six-man rotation some of the weeks that they don't have a break for, you know, 14, 18 days or something.
They're definitely going to want to skip some Ryu starts. There's no way that they're riding him one every 5 days all season long. No way.
And like, look, Kikuchi hasn't really missed time ever in his career. Like, you go back even through his Japanese League seasons, and he was pretty consistently a 150-inning guy. But that's it, right? Like, he threw more than 165 innings once in his career, including Japan. So he's probably a guy like Ryu that you want to get the odd off days to. I'm curious to see with Kikuchi, too, if they change the pitch mix at all. Like, he threw four pitches pretty consistently last year. Something the Jays have at times done is ditch your worst pitch and focus on throwing the three good ones. Yeah.
You said it where you go, hey, I don't know how much of it is being facetious or not. Mm-hmm. I am a believer in Pete Walker. I really am. Remember that Mets rumor where it was, hey, they were looking at Pete.
And you were like, oh no, do we have to get rid of Charlie to keep Pete Walker?
Yeah. Because I believe in Pete Walker. But there is something to me where that's what I more believe in. Not that someone shows up here and you reinvent a 30-year-old pitcher and Pete Walker goes, you ever think about working out? And they go, what? And then they do the Rocky IV montage and Kikuchi blows up and gets all jacked and now he doesn't wear down at the end of seasons. No, I think that's what they do. They simplify things at times for their pitchers in a way that other organizations haven't seemed to do since Pete Walker in like 2016. And so, yeah, I believe that if there's something he can unlock with Kikuchi, it's maybe just eliminating a pitch and saying, hey, this is what's working for us right now, and we're going to go to this. And that's how business is done for a while.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm a Pete Walker guy. I believe in Pete
How
Walker.
Could you not
Pete
be?
Walker magic. Honestly, I just believe in it wholeheartedly. Yeah. But I like the process, right? I like the thinking behind this because, you guys nailed it with Ryu. There's a bit. It's going to be sort of fluid. You have three horses that are going to be there every 5 days for you. But if Ryu needs to spot, then why not go and embrace this sort of thinking and have another guy that might be only 140, 150 innings and have some other guys that are going to be able to be in there and jump into spot starts. And maybe that's the way you maximize your fourth and fifth best pitchers if you want to look at it that way. And I think it sort of alleviates the pressure there on Nate Pearson, and you can use him to the best of your ability, whether it's more development, whether it's 26, more development out of the bullpen, or maybe he's that trade chip that gets you that other piece that you need here as the offseason continues. So for that reason, I think there's some merit to this move for sure.
I saw a report from Ben Wagner that the expectation for Pearson was to break camp with the team, but I think we all know that's not true. I think we all know that it's more of a, hey, you have a chance, Nate. You have a real chance. We're not telling you that you can't make this team, even though jobs are never really won in spring training. But going out and getting Kikuchi, this is the old action speak louder than words, where you say, yeah, you can make the team, Nate. That's your expectations. You're going to be a starting pitcher who starts this year with us. And then you sign Kikuchi and go, she's got to beat the guy who made the All-Star team last year. That's all. And who we gave $36 million to. If you can beat him, then you can get on this team. It's not going to happen. You get that little bit of a buffer. Let's take a break because I need to talk to you guys about Tom Brady. It actually kept me up at night. I couldn't sleep for about an hour because I was processing this Brady news and spinning through my head about all the different things it means. But just quickly before we break, I forgot to mention it. Do you guys give Matthews a game? Does Matthews get a game, yes or no? For the cross-check?
I think he gets one.
Yeah. I think he gets one, too. It felt like you got to give him one game. What do you think, Blake?
Yeah, I think so. That's a pretty bad one. I know he'll have the benefit of, oh, well, there's no history of player safety stuff. I don't know. That's a rough one.
Yeah, he's tall, right? You can just tell this is a tall guy problem where he's going for the shoulder, and the stick, to me, just slips out. I don't think he's trying to cross-check him in the head and neck is what I'm saying. But it's just one where that's what happened, and it was flush, and you kind of go, yeah. I don't know how I'm supposed to really defend this in terms of if it ends up being a fine and it's not a suspension, I would go, okay, well, player history and blah, 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 blah. But it was kind of hard. I just know that my gut instinct when I first saw it, when it just happened right away, I went, oh, that's a game. A game. And so I'm going to stick with that, I guess. Let's take a break. Let's come back and talk about how much attention does one person need? Tom Brady, that's next. The Fan Morning Show. Blake Murphy, Justin Cuthbert, Sportsnet 59 of The Fan.
Breaking down the top stories in hockey and Elliot Friedman every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 59 of The Fan, J.D. Bunkus, Blake Murphy, Justin Cuthbert. Hit us up on Twitter or on Instagram at any time. Or just text the text line, 590-590, and we'll read them today and tomorrow when it's Text Line Tuesday. But Tom Brady, unfinished business, he says. He's coming back. He's his 23rd season in Tampa, unfinished business, LFG, he says. quote, these past 2 months, I've realized my place is still on the field and not in the stands. That time will come, but it's not now. I love my teammates and I love my supportive family. They make it possible. I'm coming back for my 23rd season in Tampa. Unfinished business. LFG. Tom Brady, the GOAT. That's what he announces. Blake, do you buy that Tom Brady's coming back because he saw LeBron James play basketball and went, oh my God, I need to go out there and play so I'm against LeBron James?
No, I just think that, yeah.
You didn't buy that? You didn't buy that story from Tom and LeBron?
No, I think he went a minute without getting attention, and that's pretty much it.
LeBron, I love, so for those of you that don't know, I shouldn't be just kind of pushing that out there. LeBron tells a story that Tom called him and that Tom told LeBron that watching him, it was a realization that it's just the two of them are going up against each other, and he was inspired by LeBron's 50-point game, and I went, I hope this is true, because Tom Brady, he's playing you like a fiddle now. He's trying to get under you where he's playing head games with you. He's saying, you're the GOAT. LeBron, he's playing to all your worst tendencies, and he's got you. He's got you in a body bag, LeBron. He's there. He's attacking the mentals. This is amazing. This is so truly incredible. He's obviously, the family thing is hilarious. Like, 2 months with your family, Tom, and that was it? And all of a sudden you realize that they're supportive now? First of all, he's in the NFL, right? It's the easiest on the family schedule, right? So I'm sure he's fine. He's living with his family down there. Everything's hunky-dory. It's all good. But to me, this is just a failed coup. Right? There's nothing more than this. This was an attempt. He wanted to go to the San Francisco 49ers, and Tampa found a way to block that. And surprisingly, for me anyways, it's that Tom Brady just agreed to come back to Tampa. Because I would think that for such a competitive guy who obviously wanted out. He doesn't retire and unretire 2 months later because he just figured out that he wants to still play football again. There's just no way. I'm not buying that story. I guess the part of it that I'm most curious about is how things played out in Tampa with his attempt to leave and go to San Francisco that so many people reported, right? Like, Mike Florio came on the show, and he mentioned we were going to get this news, by the way, right around this time. So kudos to Mike, because he kind of nailed it. But everyone was under the assumption that it was going to be some kind of a move where Tampa is a willing participant in sending him to San Francisco so that they can facilitate this and say, hey, Tom, thanks for your service. Thanks for the Super Bowl. And by all accounts, it doesn't look as though Tampa was willing to do that, that they weren't willing to just budge and give Tom Brady what he wanted despite him showing up there and winning for them.
Yeah, $15 million in dead cap is it's a lot, right? This isn't quite the Lowry Raptors situation where it's years and years of tenure. It's you came in as a mercenary. I don't know. I wouldn't have been eager to help facilitate him go somewhere else either if I were Tampa Bay.
I guess it's just a little weird in the player empowerment era, right? And we're looking at this stuff with quarterbacks, especially right now, and we set up this offseason, like, who's going to move themselves into what advantageous places? And Russell Wilson just allowed himself.
Not just player empowerment. It's Tom Brady.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
The player.
It's completely different. Like, it is actually shocking that they wouldn't bend the knee to Tom, first off, but that Tom would come back anyway is very, very strange. Like, I think he recognized that Tampa didn't have what it took this year. Like, the immediacy of his decision would make it seem like he didn't believe that he could win with Tampa Bay. Friction with Bruce Arians, perhaps. He just felt, it seemed like at least, that he didn't think he had a chance to win, and it wasn't worth it again with Tampa Bay, and he had a different team, the San Francisco 49ers, in which he wanted to go. But to go to this length, to use the family, to, you know, all this retirement, all this, you know, legacy talk and everyone reflecting and all this for 2 months, and to turn around and just go back and not get what you want, it's all very, very, very strange. And I'm happy about it. Like, the league is way better with Tom Brady in it. I actually wouldn't mind seeing a decline out of Tom Brady. If he does have that bad season, I think some people would revel in that. But the fact that he's not getting what he wants and is coming back to play football anyway, I mean, all it says to me is he wanted to hit 45, which he will, and he's going to do it. I mean, it really is shocking that he's going to play for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers after deciding 2 months ago that the Tampa Bay Buccaneers weren't worth his services.
So, Justin, you mentioned that you think he thought the Buccaneers just didn't have the horses last year or whatever. They have zero cap space. They have negative cap space, actually.
It's a declining team.
JD, how much do you think Brady comes back with, like, assurances of, like, oh, the first round pick's on the table to do this, or you know, there's always the jokes, but legitimately, like, is Gronk coming back with them, those kind of things? Because it's hard to see from the roster and cap sheet alone how this Tampa Bay team gets better around him this year.
So they were already doing that. You're in for Tom Brady. You're already deciding that you're all in, and you're saying screw cap space, because in the NFL it rolls over. And they're saying, yeah, we don't care about cap space in 2025. We care about the cap space while we have the GOAT Tom Brady. I don't know if they're really placating to him. To certain degrees, I think that they will. What'll be the next interesting thing to watch is the head coach and whether or not the Arians thing is true or not. If the Arians thing ended up being all smoke, then everything goes back to normal and Arians is the coach. If the Arians thing was real, that Tom Brady was irked by the way that he comported himself that last year, Byron Leftwich is going to be the head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And I feel as though that is the more realistic scenario here. You have to give something to Tom, right? You have to give something to Tom Brady. He's still Tom Brady. I'm guessing that the organization looked at this and said, okay, Tom, we know you want to go to San Francisco. You're trying to make this happen. We don't want you to go to San Francisco. The NFC is wide open. We've done everything we can to build a good offensive line for you. We've done everything we can. We just hit Chris Godwin with the franchise tag. We're not letting him go anywhere. That we think that the defense was beat up last season, that they had a dip of a year, but they're going to bounce back, and we're going to be the best team in this division. Look around us. Sean Payton's gone from New Orleans, all right? That's a team that beat us a couple times. Let's see if Dennis Allen can get that done with God knows what at quarterback next year. Like, really? Let's see if the Carolina Panthers, who still haven't figured out their quarterback situation, whether or not they can get it done against us next year. Do you think that that's going to happen? Okay, now let's look at the NFC landscape as a whole. Aaron Rodgers is returning with the Packers, and they've choked every single year in the playoffs. If you want to talk about a team that kind of relates to the Maple Leafs, maybe it's a little bit of the Packers recently, where, oh, a lot of regular season hype and somehow barely getting out of first rounds for them. The Niners aren't getting a quarterback because you were supposed to be their one. What are they going to do now? Trade for Deshaun Watson? Is that what's on the table for the Niners? Well, they're going to be competing against Philadelphia. They're going to be competing against a bunch of teams. The Rams, that's who's running it back. It just the NFC is wide open. And so I wonder if they just sort of looked at this and went, no, man, no. We compete here. You have a good chance to win here, and we think you have a good chance to win here. So they just held him to his contract. They held him to the deal that he negotiated. But he's still Tom Brady, and you cannot have the resentment of him having to come back and not getting his way without figuring out other stuff to do. So, yeah, Blake, I don't know if they're going to say we're going to screw up our team's future entirely to add around the margins for you, but I do think it's a situation where you watch the head coach and you watch how much control he has, say, over the playbook or how things are operated this final season. You have to placate to Tom Brady. Probably logically you should if you really want to win, but I also think there has to be a measure of the organization saying, hey, Tom's back. This is Tom's organization. This is Tom's team. Tom runs things a certain way. He has more power than the average quarterback does.
He has more power than just about anyone at any position. So the head coaching one's interesting, especially after Leftwich was obviously in a lot of rumors and a lot of interviews and then didn't move.
Those two are tight. Those two are tight. That's who he works out with. Do you guys remember the first story of Tom Brady going to Tampa Bay, how he showed up in the wrong house? The wrong house was supposed to be Byron Leftwich's. Since the beginning, he's been with Leftwich. The two of them have reportedly worked side by side. That was the reports with Bruce Arians in the first place. It was, hey, he and Tom gets frustrated when Bruce starts to try calling plays or trying to implement his offense because they don't feel as though he's involved in this thing. That it's Leftwich and Brady that come up with the game plans, that Leftwich and Brady are the brains behind the offense, and that whenever Bruce ends up doing stuff, they're kind of like, huh, Bruce, just stick to the sideline. We don't need you involved in any of this.
Not good enough for the Jaguars head coaching job, apparently.
Yeah, I'm not saying that he's definitely a goner. All I'm saying is if it is true that Tom didn't like Bruce Arians, I would guess that Tom ends up winning this coup versus a coach. That this doesn't come down to Tampa saying Bruce isn't going anywhere if Tom puts that on the table. If Tom put that on the table to return as a this is a face-saving measure to me having to come back. Because, yeah, I think Tom Brady, even in his bubble of yes-men that he probably exists within, there's not a part of him that believes this. The public buys the whole he was away for 2 months with his family and then he decided to unretire from the Tampa Bay. He rolled out all those Tampa Bay Buccaneers things and took all that heat from Patriots fans because he was saying goodbye to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers alone always. That was always just the plan.
We should have known then. But, like, this guy is so different. Like, he wields so much power. He can probably change the coach, have whatever he wants in Tampa Bay. And yet, the greatest quarterback of all time, one of the greatest athletes in history, had to use his own retirement as leverage to try and get what he want and didn't get what he want. It really is incredible, the aspects at play and dynamics at play here. Yeah. I'm frankly just shocked that he didn't get what he wants, and he's got his tail tucked between his legs, and he's going back to the, of all teams, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers stood their ground. It's pretty remarkable.
I just look at this now and say, Blake, for your salary cap question, it's more a matter of, do they try and restructure some deals now? Because that's the interesting thing with the salary cap in the NFL is you go, how are they going to do this? And then all of a sudden, two guys sign extensions and
there's money in the banana stand.
Yeah, there is. There's always money in the banana stand.
The way the NFL salary cap works, yeah.
So I'm not too concerned.
At a Mike Evans in particular, because he's, I believe this is the last year of his deal.
Exactly. They'll find ways to get underneath the salary cap. And I don't know. We'll see what ends up happening here, because now this is NFL transaction time, right? Tom is back right ahead of NFL transaction time. So that to me tells – that says one thing. It goes, Tom Brady is back in Tampa, so prospective free agents, you don't need to worry. You don't need to figure things out. That's why Mike was saying this was going to be the timing of it, is because if he was going to go to San Francisco, it was a similar thing. Guys in San Francisco likely would have sacrificed had they known that a Super Bowl is potentially on the table and maybe they can get more money down the line. They would have reconfigured deals. They would have known that. Free agents would know that. All kinds of different stuff. So, yeah,
and
I wonder.
Tomorrow the window opens to negotiate with UFAs, yeah. And Thursday they can sign, I believe, is the way this works. So on top of the draft being 6 weeks away.
Now I'm wondering how much Tom, as we're talking this out, how long he's already known that he's going to come back to Tampa and how long he's been tampering with the guys that he wants to come here. Because
not tampering if you're just a retired player and sharing your experience about Tampa Bay.
Free reign yeah. These last 2 months.
That's what I mean, is I wonder what he is. Let's take a break. Let's come back and talk to my old pal, Ben Ennis. Blue Jays spring training opens up. We're here. So spring training stories. What to make of an attempted return of a villain? I'm a little emotionally fragile after that.
I have a take on him being qualified as a villain. That's...
Oh, he's beyond a villain. He's a beyond a villain.
Oh, I was going to say he's not even close. He's just like... the first henchman you knock off
villain. No, you forget how quickly you forget.
I don't forget.
How quickly you forget.